or not. If you aren't a parent, then you're a very good home quarterback about what's wrong with everyone else's children. I don't have any children, and I'm an expert in what what's wrong with my friends' kids. In the studio with me, and it is our privilege in the studio and your privilege at home, to have really an internationally known expert on infant care, Magda Gerber. She is the founder and the director of Resources for Infant Educarers, and I will spell that for you. It's E-D-U-C-A-R-E-R-S, a term that she originated. She was trained as an infant specialist in Budapest, Hungary, where she assisted Emmy Peckler, and she has adapted her work to the United States. She arrived in 1957, and she has an extensive background in infant care and development. With us are some local specialists. We have Connie McKee. She's the program leader for Bunnell House. Diane Suskind, who is the educational consultant, and she studied with Magda in California. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Carol Bryce, who's worked for many years as a volunteer with RCPC, Resource Center for Parents and Children, and she's now a partner in Family Training Associates, which is has its primary focus as parent-infant communication.
Very good.
Right, communication. Right. And also our privilege to have Leanne Converse. She is a family physician, and she treats the whole family. So we also welcome all callers. This afternoon, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what happened this afternoon, but a number of people in the community had a chance to attend a workshop that was given this afternoon. And anyone who has questions from that that they didn't get a chance to ask, or those people who have not had a chance to talk to Magda since she's been here, which is only 24 hours after all, please feel free to call in. Our number is 474-5044, and I welcome your phone calls at any time. We will start out with Magda. What happened this afternoon in Fairbanks?
Well, many, many things happened. There was a big fair with many people, many children, many parents who seemed to enjoy whatever was available. And there was a workshop. Was it a workshop? What was the name of the workshop? I forgot.
What do infants tell us?
What do infants tell us? Which is a wonderful way of introducing child development. The best way is to listen to our infants, not necessarily the words they say, but what they express with their behavior. They do want to express how they feel about what we do to them. And if we listen, then we develop that most important first dialogue between parent and child.
This is quite a difference from the 50s, when there was a very prescriptive set of rules that children should be on four-hour feeding schedules, and they should do this at so many months and that at so many months, and anything else was not quite right. You're saying that children, even at that very early age, have a lot of things to tell us.
Well, they can tell us how they feel about what we do to them. And it would be quite nice if we would listen to how they feel and not know better how they feel. And by the way, the prescriptions go on forever and have always been. The only difference is it changes.
Right. Which can be very confusing for a parent.
We were
talking before the show, and I said that it's my understanding that it's very difficult not to parent as your parents parented you. I have many friends and my sisters as well who say things come out of your mouth that you just don't even know where they came from, and suddenly you realize this is what you were told when you were a child. It's
even
very difficult to erase that tape.
Even more so, this is what you hated to hear when you were a child, mm-hmm. and then you hate to hear it when it comes out of your own mouth.
And what do we do about that?
Well,
that's too much of a question. I'll have to pare that down. But we do listen to the old tapes, and then we also listen to what the magazines and what the latest expert advice to women is about what should be happening with their children, and it is difficult. How does an individual parent sort it out?
Well, it would be easy to say, to use a little common sense, but somebody once mentioned that it's not so common anymore to have common sense. So what is common sense, really? I think that if we can listen to our own self, and if we can decide what makes us feel good and what we like from another person and what we dislike. And one of the things I keep repeating many, many times is one of the things we all like from people who are important to us is to get full, undivided attention. It cannot be given for too long of a time. But even the short times of full attention, and what that means, that during that time you suspend, you don't want to teach, you don't want to correct, you don't want to stimulate, you are just open, you are really just there for the other person. And so you are the person to express themselves.
And not judgmental and without expectations of what the child should be doing at that moment.
Exactly. There are no shoulds. Both people are there and something happens. And if you can give that kind of attention to your baby, then they really learn to let you know about themselves a great deal, and that's the greatest present you really can give. And it's not that difficult once you get the feel for it. But unfortunately, most parents are being given so many shoulds. You should teach, you should stimulate, you should push, give your children all kinds of educational toys and all kinds of things, that you even forget what it is to just be there and even enjoy.
Our time is much more spoken for, at least spoken for outside the home. A few years ago, your time might have been very taken up, but there was a lot of time in the home for most women who were not forced to work. So that is a factor. Most women in Alaska, even with very young children, do work now out of economic necessity or preference, one or the other. And that's a problem. And then to spend what they call quality time, that becomes like a buzzword. You panic. What's quality time? What's quality time? What do I have to do?
I try to write about quality time, and I try to kind of differentiate between two kinds of quality time. The one is the one we just talked about, which is, I call it, I want nothing quality time. Which means that hopefully I don't even think what I'm going to cook a half an hour later. So I am just really available emotionally and cognitively and available to that other person.
So it's very important to stop the lists that
to
are going
have
in your head.
Your mind while you are there, oh, I should be doing this or that, then it's not quality time. So that's the one area. The other is a different area. And very important one. The other is all the time that any either parent or substitute parent in daycare centers or in other situations must spend on a one-to-one with the other child. I mean, we have not yet invented diapering via distance. So we are there, our buddies are there. And we are in very close proximity to the child. And sadly, these times when we have to be there anyway, so it's not an additional investment, we don't use the way it could be used. I have my own way of observing. And if I see anybody who diapers a child only looking at the lower part of the body of the baby, that means that they don't interact. The baby's buttocks gets cleaned and the wet diaper gets exchanged by a dry diaper. But all the many things that can go on and should go on and could go on while you do it. First of all, you're very close to the baby. You can look at each other. You can interact with each other. You can tell the child of anything and everything that is going to happen, which is very important learning because the child learns to predict, to anticipate. You involve the child. You expect the child to be an active partner. You know, so you do a task together. It's not you do it to the baby, but together you help this process. And you expect the child to help. And you tell your newborn, I want you to lift your buttocks a little bit. And obviously the newborn doesn't know yet, but it will. They will learn.
Presumably, if you spend this kind of concentrated time with your child, what would the payoffs be? What would be
It has an enormous payoff. The payoff is that after, I like to call these times refueling, but refueling for both, for the child and the parent. And after that time, the parent can happily put the child down in his or her environment, which is hopefully safe and interesting, and then expect that child to happily explore and initiate and play. So this is the almost opposite of what is being done most often, which is that mothers carry babies around with them all the time and are neither with the baby. They are really not with the child. Only the buddies are together. And then the child can neither separate. So it is a pseudo-togetherness. And I like a real togetherness and then real separateness. And I know that not only babies, but parents need it, and not only parents, but babies need these times. And then they can again be together with joy.
This definition of self versus the parent or the caregiver is an ongoing process that occurs over the first couple of years.
Yes.
What's interesting to me is how different children are, really from, I'm not objective, but I certainly am an observer because I'm not a parent, how different children are at a very young age, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, just vastly different. And presumably this kind of concentrated paying attention would teach you something about the character of this infant that is before you.
I like to tell that the way the little boy learned about E.T. is the way we should learn about our E.T. A baby is an E.T., comes from somewhere else. And to learn about his own characteristics, we have to pay attention.
Leanne, this is Dr. Converse, who is a family physician for our audience's benefit. What are your thoughts on what Magda has just said or what you see in your practice in terms of the way people in general approach infant care these days?
Oh, what was occurring to me when I was listening to her talk was kids and even infants are so different. There's a very placid baby who you can do pretty much anything and the baby's very content. You can walk off and leave it and the baby's fine. You can be with it. The baby's fine. And then you have the very demanding baby that seems to, no matter what you do, nothing pleases it. I was wondering if she had any suggestions for those parents, especially who have the very difficult child in pleasing it, that one especially, but also in how to, as she puts it, be with her very placid baby that doesn't seem to demand anything either. I think that they're two extremes.
Well, about a very demanding baby, and you know, there are many researches done on young babies crying a lot. Even the placid baby cries. And this happens more the first 2 to 2.5 months of life. And if parents could learn that this is not a bad certificate of their own parenting, but it means that a baby starts living outside, which means really, it means a bigger change than when you go up to the moon. and have to, everything is new. You have to adapt to everything. So if you respect that and you don't blame yourself or the baby's father or whatever, but help that child to overcome. In my view, you best help if you attenuate the environment, not make it more exciting. Because I'm always surprised when people want to put more stimulation to an infant, and I try to explain, can you imagine what it means for a person who has never seen anything, such as a light and a room and a crib or anything? Everything is new. Would you want to add newness to that? So we like to say, simplify the environment, make it a little quieter, a little simpler, and then it will be easier for babies to adapt to that.
What about the second part of that, to feel a real connection between a parent and a really placid, undemanding baby that just seems to...
You know, unless a child is really not healthy or has some real difficulties within normalcy, no baby is that placid. There are some slower babies. They maybe the mother of that so-called placid baby is expected a more active baby. But all babies are interested at times. And also, of course, young babies are sleeping a great deal. I once got a phone call from a mother who said, my child sleeps so much, is that a wrong sign? And I said, I will give you 20...
Seems an odd thing to complain about.
I will give you 20 telephone numbers to call other mothers whose babies do the opposite. Ask them whether that's good or bad.
I had a friend who went so crazy. She said she thought her child was half wolf. It never slept more than 20 minutes at a stretch. And she ended up in desperation throwing every clock in the house into the closet because she said unless she could suspend all time for a year or so, she was going to go mad, you know. And once she had no idea whether he'd slept 20 minutes or 4 hours and got into some kind of twilight zone herself, she regained her sense of
humor. Well, you know, we do the opposite of that. We ask a parent to use colorful or colored crayons and to make a map on kind of a quarter of hourly basis of sleeping, eating, crying, whatever babies do. And usually parents are surprised how their subjectively misjudge the time.
You know, 15 minutes.
The parent who says, 15 minutes felt many hours.
Right.
You know, and
15 minutes of crying seems like 4 hours.
Exactly.
Right. That's right. That's right. Well, when you want to be doing something, and I think there's some real fear of what is wrong with the child. The
yes.
child just crying is means so many things. It can mean real unhappiness or discomfort or... I don't know, maybe something not very much, just...
Yeah. Well, that's the task, to learn what it means.
And that requires paying attention to the child.
That requires time and patience and paying attention. Yeah.
It is amazing to me, I would like all of you here to share sort of latest thoughts on this. It is amazing to me now, especially since we allow our children to be quite assertive, what individuals they become by 3 years old, how much they know about the world, probably because of the stimulus of TV and just the way the world goes, but how much a sense of themselves they have and what individuals they are and how much information they've absorbed in...
When you say information, I agree. Absorbed, I'm not so sure.
So you think they spit it back...
To just have information and spit it back, or even imitate, does not mean absorbed. And I am a little scared on the other side that an overload of information, which is more likely to happen, makes a person less understanding. You no longer take things seriously.
How do you control the amount of stimuli that a child gets in this world?
Whenever there's a television, I don't know how to control it. I mean, ideally, if you have a young child, you shouldn't have a television, in my mind. At least then the child actively participates in his world and then they are in control.
We have somewhat of a selective audience listening to us this evening, because we know at least at this moment that the people who are out there now are radio listeners, and our number is 474-5044, and presumably that's back to a time where at least you're stimulating your own imaging apparatus rather than having the images presented to you. 474-5044. Any of our audience who has some opinions or some questions, please feel free to call in. Carol, what is your reaction to all this? What would you like to add?
I'm sitting here writing madly and trying to keep it all under control, because I think a lot of things Magda says are so exciting, and I just want to build on a lot of the things that she says, because I think she's such a human being, and that's so important in parenting.
Aren't we all?
But in a very human kind of a way, which really says something to me about coming across to parents. I think one of my great concerns and interests is parents, how we can support them fully in the job they have ahead of them. And I really spun off of your comment about, I guess it was your comment, Patty, about 2.5 to 3 month old infants being so different in your observations. And I think it's really recognized now how very different the newborn infant is. And every newborn infant is unique and has individual characteristics. And so many moms and dads assume this is a baby and you take the book and this is the way you take care of a baby. And I am all for spending time with every mom, with every newborn infant, and trying to point out to her the particular characteristics that her baby has, so that if she's going to go home with a baby that's been really irritable in the nursery, that someone says to that mom, you've got a set of circumstances to deal with at home, and it's not going to be as restful as you might have thought. The baby may cry quite a bit because the baby's been crying here quite a bit, but it probably is the pattern that this baby has, so that this mom doesn't go home and interpret that as a sick baby or a bad baby, but that she sees this perhaps as a healthy baby with just this particular characteristic.
Or she doesn't see herself as a failed parent
because
the child is not behaving according to some prescriptive way. We have a caller. You're on the air, please.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Converse.
Go right ahead.
I'd like to ask her to talk a little bit about sibling rivalry, since she does a lot of pediatric work with numerous children in the family, and how to deal with a new baby.
That's a good one, because I was wondering, I was going to pose that same problem to Magda when she was talking about giving the individual attention to a child and being there for the child and that one child only, or that one person only, and how you dealt with the siblings at the same time. I think it's very important for each child to know that he is respected and appreciated as an individual in his own right. And I think with several kids, and especially with working parents who don't have a lot of time to spend with their kids, it's real tough. I'm going to punt and give this question to Magda to see if she has any suggestions for us.
Well, I think you already said it, but partly we even already talked about it. If you have given individual attention, that kind of special attention, to that baby who grew up, let's take with the oldest child, you already knew he got it and can get it. Another suggestion would be that when you have a new baby, that's the time when the older child usually gets very uptight. Pay more attention to the older one. The young baby will be well off. People usually pay over attention to the baby, and then the older one suffers. And of course, you allow the older one to. You don't tell them you must like your new sister and brother, God forbid. Mm-hmm. But you even may gently encourage, all that noise, we lived so quietly before we had that baby screaming, wasn't it? You know, something so the child doesn't feel guilty that they feel that way. And, of course, pay lots of attention to each one.
Do you have something, listener, to add to this? Hello?
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
It would be nice to know the ages of the children. We didn't ask.
That's true.
Oh. Yeah, and children are very individual. Sometimes you have children close in age that get along very well, and sometimes they really don't like each other. And
sometimes it lasts for a lifetime.
We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Could you give some recommendations on dealing with a baby that has turned colicky?
Now they're pointing at each other, audience. Everyone is trying to hand this one off. Okay, both of you will have to answer. Dr. Converse first.
I think a colicky baby is probably one of the biggest frustrations parents ever run up against, because they feel like such bad people and bad parents and such failures as parents. And that's a real tough thing to deal with, because the baby cries, and you feed it, and you diaper it, and you talk to it, and you walk it, and you put it down in the crib, and it cries, and no matter what you do, it cries. And you feel like something's terribly wrong, or either with the baby or with you. And you try all the little tricks. And sometimes something works with one baby, and sometimes something works with another. I think the thing to keep in mind is that it goes away. And in about 3 months, most kids quit, and you have both survived it, even though you think you aren't going to. And that's a hard thing to keep in mind in the middle of the night when the baby's been crying for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how you feel, but in Europe, in many, many countries, they offer chamomile tea to... and, you know, colic, basically, it's a big bag name for many things. It means that a child feels pain, bubbles in his stomach, air in his stomach. We don't know. I think the name colic already frees a parent a little bit, because they say, well, what can I do? I have a colicky baby. So to that extent, it's a good word. It is a little bit of guilt relieving.
Most people define colic based on a period of a certain time a day that the child has discomfort. That's not true. How do we even get to the term colicky?
I think colic is a term for a crying baby that you can't find an answer for,
right,
essentially. And yes, there is a pattern to a lot of babies crying, but if you can't put a name on why the baby's crying, then you call it colic.
And by the way, the time they cry most frequently is, of course, around dinner time, which coincides with the time when the mother is a little more tense and she wants to do three things at the same time. So for that, the answer is try to do things in a different sequence. Feed the baby much earlier, be ready so you don't have to get into that tension too
Carol,
much.
Carol, you wanted to say something?
I just think that, again, I'd like to add that babies that have special concerns like this have moms that need some special nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe moms that need to not feel guilty about needing a little more time away, that maybe need husbands or other support systems to really carry them through this time, even if it takes somebody really talking to the both of them and helping them understand that it's okay to need that extra little bit of help, because this is a very stressful situation. It's one of many that's probably going to come up during child rearing.
Our phone number for the audience is 474-5044, 474-5044. That is especially difficult for a lot of families in that both parents work. And so especially if there are other children, even if they're not, to race home from work and to try and deal with all your child's needs and your own needs, it's very cumbersome, and there's a certain amount of guilt that comes mm-hmm. from that. I've talked to some mothers this week who feel badly. They feel they have their children, their infants, in very good hands, whether in an infant care center or with individuals, but they have to come back to work after 3 month maternity leave, and they feel they're missing a lot, and their child has needs that maybe someone other than the parent won't be so sensitive to. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's we have to acknowledge as a society. Of it distresses me that even mothers who stay home full time feel some guilt that they should be also pursuing a career, and that we don't give enough credit to the full-time job that parenting is. At the same time, we have to be very sensitive and acknowledge that there are many women that must work, many men that must work, who would like to spend some more time parenting. And I would like to see us as a society take away the negatives of that we've sort of developed around this parenting process.
I think one thing Magda said today in her workshop, which I particularly have given a lot of thought to in the past couple of hours, is how important it is for parents to talk very honestly about their feelings, even to infants and very young children. And I think this whole issue of crying babies is an example of the real need for parents to honestly look at and talk about their feelings. Because I think sometimes it's very easy to talk about a crying baby. Babies cry. They're going to cry forever because that's a characteristic of babies. So it's a very acceptable thing to talk about. But very often, there are other agendas. There are other things going on that are equally as important. And the mom maybe needs help talking about those other things. Maybe it's guilt over staying home. Maybe it's guilt over going to work. Maybe it's sibling rivalry. I mean, there could be a lot of things going on in that home. But what comes out verbally is the baby cries a lot.
Mm-hmm. Also, of course, you know, crying is a great irritant, whether you love a baby or don't, but you become upset, frustrated, angry. And the next thing after being angry is you feel guilty because you could smash the kid to the wall. I mean, theoretically. And
you'd
I
like
think,
to.
Yeah, you would like to. Mm-hmm. And I think that to acknowledge that while you are a caring, good, nice mother, you also get very angry with the kid and cannot always be this smiling, loving, you know, described in Better Homes and Gardens. So that in itself, to allow yourself to be a human being who responds with positive as well as negative feelings, in my mind, if one would work on that, there would be a little less abuse. Mm-hmm. Not more. You know, people say you don't allow people because then they will never be able to control themselves. It's the other way around.
Okay. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. For the very early infant, can a child perceive a difference between his parents and, let's say, the daycare he'd be receiving 5 days out of the week?
Yeah. Who do you...
Yes, I really feel that they can distinguish that. They know from birth who their mom and their father are. That is something from birth that they really pick up very quickly. I think it's very important for the child to have a consistent caregiver because they do need that on a one-to-one, and they need someone that is going to be there that have the same feelings that they can give to that child on a day-to-day basis.
Do you think that a child can perceive the difference in role from parent to daycare?
Yes. Parents are definitely going to treat the child different than what a caregiver is because each person is different to begin with. And so they're going to know that. I think the important thing, again, is to go ahead and make sure that that infant has, you know, a consistent person. And then they're going to be able to relate to the mother and the father, and they're going to be able to relate to that same daycare on a day-to-day basis.
Any idea what time period it would take for a baby to adjust to the switch over from constant care from parents to a 5-day-a-week daycare?
Well, that would be, are you speaking about, you know, from birth, putting it directly in, say, 6 weeks of age into a daycare setting, or are you talking about a baby that's 2, 3, 4, 5 months old?
Baby 2, 3, 4, 5 months old.
Okay. Well, it's going to take them a while, probably, I would say, anywhere from a month to 2 months. It's a slow process, but as long as they know that it's the same person, they're going to be bonding with that person, and they're going to be adapting to that on a day-to-day basis. It's when you start changing a person that they start feeling mixed feelings, and you're maybe going to be seeing a much more unhappy infant at home crying, or, you know, it knows that different people are handling it. So it is going to have an adjustment period to go through.
And I think we need to put some of this into some historical perspective. in the past, when just maintaining the home involved making soap, candle making, and so on, which is not that many years ago, we did not have the time as mothers, historically speaking, to devote full attention. That this kind of idea of sort of modern society, vacuum cleaners, everything that would allow a lot of hours of individual caregiving is a fairly recent phenomenon. And when women were part of farm families, they had a lot of duties to perform. So, you know, I think we can get too hysterical about how much concentrated time is required for good parenting. We have another caller. Hello, I'm sorry I've left you waiting so long. You're on the air.
That's okay. I've been enjoying the discussion. I have two questions. One area is any suggestions for children that wake up parents all during the night when they're babies, I'm referring to. And is there some age in which Mrs. Magda would suggest letting the baby cry itself back to sleep and training it into sleeping all night or anything else? And the other question was about nursing a baby with teeth, and when it bites, you hit the baby to get it to stop. Those are my two questions.
Two tough ones. This is very difficult to talk about unless one can spend lots of time talking about it. Usually people tend to think in two extremes. The one extreme being never let your baby cry, which of course we all know is impossible. And the other extreme is let them cry it out. What we try to help parents is that you don't let a child cry. You let the child know you are there. You go to the child. However, we believe that the less help you give after you are there, the better. For many, many reasons. Number one, if you want to promote autonomy, you don't say, I will rescue you for everything that's bad in the world. That's the message. But I can be around and be helpful to you. So I'm supportive of you, but I don't, you know, I cannot take over all your pains. That's the one reason. And the other reason is that if you start with just talking to a child, for instance, that's much easier to do than walking a child for a half night. So start with something that you can do easily, because unfortunately when we introduce something with a child that is hard on us, sooner or later we will resent the child for wanting what we introduced. And that becomes a very difficult pattern. The third reason is that it's always easy to escalate. It's very difficult to de-escalate. So if you first just talk to a child and it doesn't work, and you slowly put a hand on the child, just giving them the body feeling, and that may not work, then you can talk and touch. So, you know, that's easier to do, but most parents go in, become very excited themselves, pick up the child, grab the child out of the crib, and then have to put the child back into the crib, and the child screams more and more. So try to do the minimal, and you can work on it. But don't abandon a child, especially middle of the night. The other thing, don't make night visits very attractive. You know, by picking them up and walking them around, it's almost worth getting up to get that treatment. Basically, you don't want to do it night after night.
You're a baby. Yes, you're a baby. Giving her opinion.
How old is the baby?
Well, she's 11 months now, and she now wakes me up once or twice a night, and I can live with that. It's certainly better than it was, but it's been a long haul, and she's still only...
You know, unfortunately, at different ages, they cry for different reasons.
Yeah.
And around 11, it's really the time of separation, fears and anxieties, and sometimes a baby who didn't cry when they were younger starts crying around that time. So a certain kind of peaceful reassurance. At the same time, don't hesitate to tell your child how you feel, that you are sleepy yourself and you don't enjoy, you rather will play next morning, and right now you want to go back to bed. Really just tell them, simply.
Well, they don't have the concept that you have to get up and go to work in the morning, or that you have to get up and take care of other children in the morning and have other responsibilities. They're sort of
this
timeless.
Is an important issue.
Well, could I ask one more thing then? Would you suggest not nursing the baby in the nighttime if it cries? Just talking to it?
Well, by 11 months, I would not nurse a baby. No. Uh-huh. I would rather offer them either light tea or water or something just to drink. Babies much more often get thirsty than hungry.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, breastfeeding is nutrition. They don't need nutrition. They just sometimes dry out and need some liquid.
Yeah, she doesn't need nutrition.
She needs nutrition.
No, she doesn't.
She doesn't.
No, she's got plenty of extra. But what about the other question?
Biting.
Biting the nipple.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know. How did you react when...
Well, the first time was, ouch, you know, very loud noise, and that startled her and reduced her to tears, but that wasn't enough. She kept it up for a couple weeks, and I had all kinds of advice, like hit her right in the mouth, or slap her in the leg good and hard, yell right in your ear.
No, you just stop feeding at that point.
It's telling you. Yeah.
I mean, you tell the child, no, if you bite, I won't feed you. I won't feed you with the breast. I give you maybe a chewing cracker or something to bite. And by the way, you do encourage that they can chew on toys or on anything. Because sometimes when they get their teeth, isn't that true? Mm-hmm. They like to bite, and their gums need that feeling, but not your breast. By the way, this is also important to say that when a child pulls hair or does something to a mother, don't let it be. It's really neither good for you nor for the child. You just say very simply and very businesslike, no, I don't want you to do that.
Doesn't
and,
that
know,
go
be
back?
Persistent.
Again, on if you can start communicating with them as a small infant, that you can express yourself how you're feeling, even though they're going through different stages of the developmental stage, and they're getting to 11 months or 12 months. Sure, they're still an infant, but you can still talk to them and express how you're feeling. And I think it makes it easier once you've done that as an infant to continue that.
Yes, and you do let know when something you don't want. I don't want you to do that.
You need to have respect for the children, but the children also must have respect
have
for you.
Have to learn it. Right.
Audience, our number is 474-5044. And I encourage you to call in. Thank you very much for your calls. Very interesting questions. Diane, you are responsible for Magda being here, and we haven't even heard from you.
I know.
Do you have any?
I've been so quiet. This is the quietest I've ever been in my life.
That's true.
But don't have to say that's true. Well, I'm in just awe of her, and I'm really glad that I studied with her. She kind of gave me the ability to see with another pair of eyes. I know 3 to 5 year olds, and I have my doctorate in that, but I don't know about infants, and I also want to have an infant. And I was afraid of them, and I was afraid of the crying, and I was afraid that I couldn't be a good mother. And so I needed to come and learn. The idea that Magda's taught me the most is this idea of respecting, and what kind of a child, can you hear me? What kind of a child do you want this person to grow up to be? And I want it to be a person that respects itself and that has a sense of the sense of autonomy and the sense of knowing who they are and not feel competitive to do other things. You have a phone call?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
You're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, I have a question for Magda, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Today there seems to be a lot of emphasis placed on the early education of children. The earlier the better, particularly starting in the prenatal stages. And I wonder if Magda would comment on the infant stimulation programs that are available to produce this great super baby.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to hang up so I can listen to a question on the radio.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Welcome. This caller, in case it was hard to hear her in the studio, so maybe some of our audience had difficulty. She's referring to the new super baby syndrome, where you're showing them flashcards when they're barely focusing.
It's my favorite topic, so okay. I'm awfully happy. I have an opportunity to talk about it. You see, what we stand for, I will go a little bit in a roundabout way. What we stand for is helping a person, a human being, to grow authentic, A-U-T-H, authenticity. And interestingly, people do everything possible to counteract that. And they do it in two opposite ways. The one is that they push a child, stress a child, hurry a child. Maybe you heard about the book, The Hurried Child, to perform and to do things they are not ready. And how do we know whether they are ready? That's the simplest thing on earth. If we allow them to move freely, to play freely, what they are ready for, they will do. So very simply, if they don't do it, that means they are not ready to do. So that's the one thing that we push them. And the other thing is we withhold them from doing what they are ready. So in other ways, a child who is always carried cannot learn how to move well, because we withheld them from being able to move around. A child who is taught how to play is withheld to play the way it would be best for them to play, which would be to initiate any interaction with an object. So it's so interesting that it would be so easy for parents, and of course professional parents, which means the people who do it in daycare centers, to provide this environment, sit back, be in awe, and enjoy. That is the prescription. But rather than relax and enjoy, people push and withhold and become so busy and tired and frustrated, and tire and frustrate the babies. Yes, Diane, you seem to want to say something.
I think it goes back to your original question that a lot of mothers are having children at an older age, and they've already have a career, and now they're home having a child, and they think, well, I have to have a super baby. I have to. It's almost like a business, you know, and that's why they start to think that.
Well, it is a creation. You have to create this super something.
Right.
You have to show that whatever you do, whether you are an executive or whatever.
Well, we have much more intimacy in our expectation that the child's successes we can take credit for, and the child's failures are also our fault as parents these days. I think that the reading I've done in the past, I think maybe people's lives were so otherwise involved, or they had more children, they didn't have the options to concentrate and have these kind of incredible expectations. And those parents that did were called overbearing. I'm speaking back several decades now.
Unfortunately, there's another issue here. Babies have become a market for money makers.
Right, a commodity.
And a commodity. And many, many people keep selling things to parents in a way that's very hard for even a very bright, intelligent, commonsensical parent to not do.
Do you think
when somebody dares to tell them the nonsense that unless you do these and these things, the child's brain will not develop to its fullest. You know,
pray to our worst fears.
I mean, who would be the parent who would dare not to buy the products, not to take the classes, and not to do? In Los Angeles, where everything is more exaggerated, I hope they don't listen to that radio show in Los Angeles, but people come to our program with two month-old babies, and when we decide which day would fit them, they look at their calendar and they say, Monday we have swim, Tuesday we have gym, Thursday we have mommy and me.
And French,
you know,
Monday.
And whatever. And that's for young babies. And, you know, these babies are not even allowed to sleep when sleepy, eat when hungry, relax, because they are programmed.
Well, we're doing that. The whole computer advertising thing, one feels that your child, there's one computer ad. If your kid didn't have a computer, they're going to go to college and fail. And that's a true. I mean, I'm not speaking
not
against
so
computers,
computer.
But I'm... Surely.
It's salesmanship that everybody wants to sell, and everybody says, unless you buy my product, you will feel lousy.
And expensive clothes for babies. It's
yeah.
really big.
Designer
yeah,
Pampers. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to hear some comments on the topic of a family bed versus the current, culturally acceptable pattern of requiring children to sleep in separate beds and separate bedrooms.
Should be particularly interesting in Alaska. Magda?
Well, I don't know whether you will like my answer. I once was asked to do that on television, but they had 1 minute or less for one question. And they asked me the question, and I said, goodness, how do I explain this very complicated issue? So to make it simple, I said, there is nothing inherently good or bad. It depends why you do it, what you have in mind, what is your goal. And to come out strong, I said, if you are 4 inches, the best beginning is the family bed. So it may sound too strong for many people who tend to believe in it, but I really prefer everybody to stay in their own bed, and babies learn to sleep well and be very happy. And though I try to read everything that speaks for the family bed, it doesn't fit my way of thinking.
Leanne, you had some thoughts on that?
I think it depends on the individual family. I think that that's a lot of cultural thing, and in our society it isn't acceptable. In earlier societies it was quite acceptable, and that's the way people were raised. I don't know myself whether there is a right or wrong answer to that one.
Carol.
I just want to say one other aspect of looking at that issue, and I agree with you, Leanne, that sometimes that does play in, but a lot of parents complain about children waking up during the night, and when you go and talk to them, you find out that they started out in a common bed with the parents, and the parents moved them when they were ready to go to sleep. And there is this whole orientation thing that we all experience, and children are no different, and infants are no different. But if they wake up suddenly in the middle of the night in a different place than they were put to bed in, they're very confused and disoriented, and they come fully wide awake trying to figure out where I am and what's going on. So that's a real consideration here. So sometimes you have to go back to why the question's being asked, but if you're having problems with children waking up during the night and you're moving them from a sofa or from the floor in front of the TV and then putting them in their bed, that's something to think about.
But there are some children who are very resistant to going to sleep in their own bed, and then they really make a deal out of falling asleep somewhere else.
This is a very complex topic, but whenever a parent feels either guilty or just ambivalent about an issue, and whenever a parent feels sorry for a child, that child will sense it and will not like it, whatever the issue is. If you feel sorry for a child to please peacefully on the floor because you think it's better for the child to be in your mother's arm, in his mother's arm, then that child will be unhappy on the floor. So I think it is the attitude, again, of the parent and the belief system. And by the way, in the country I come from, in Hungary, Many, many poor people slept together, not because of choice, but because they didn't have that many beds. As soon as they could afford one more bed, they happily separated. So they never thought that they did it out of how wonderful it is together. It was always better to, and also in my mind, it does interfere with marital life.
Also, you have demand breastfeeding. That happens,
that's
right?
A whole other big issue.
I think, too, parents start out, like if they do have a colicky baby, like we talked earlier, they've paced the floor, they've done everything they can mm-hmm. for it, and nothing's working, and so what they end up doing is putting the child in bed with them because they're close and they're not crying, and as soon as they lay them down, it starts again. So they have a tendency to maybe start a habit that really wasn't there to begin with. Yeah. And they have them in a bed, and then they have the problem existing how to separate that again.
Right, and they got what started as just something that they did as an expedient mm-hmm. then becomes a habit that right. they didn't intend to.
Right, as Magna said before, you know, they rush into the baby, they pick the baby up, and that felt good to the baby, but didn't want to be laid back down again, so what do I do? Well, we'll go
and
back to my...
And they are tired. They are very tired.
Right.
They want to go back to bed, so...
So they take the child with
yes,
them. So mom, dad, everybody can get some sleep. And so yes. here we have baby in bed with parents.
A listener, did you have some other comments on that?
I guess I just wanted to say a little closing thing for myself is that I really do think it's important that parents who feel like they want to do what feels comfortable for them and good for them, and I think that if sleeping as a family feels good for them and that they feel they're showing their child a lot of love, especially if both parents work, it's a really neat, close time for the family to be together when maybe they don't see each other very much during the day. Or if they do have a child that they find to be a very timid child or a lot of different reasons, for whatever reasons that the parents feel that it's the right type of parenting to have the child sleep with them all night, part of the night start there or whatever, that I think it's important for parents to feel that it's perfectly all right to do that. And that's something that I think a lot of parents are having to overcome, a cultural barrier there in our society right now, to feel that that's an okay thing to do as parents.
Any reaction to that comment? No? Thank you very much. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Patty. I'm calling in to ask Dr. Gerber a question. I've been listening, and this all sounds very interesting, but I was wondering if there's some place in town or any way she would suggest we get information after she leaves. I know she's in town for just a short time. If she can recommend books or if there's a person or classes or something like that. I've got to hang up, but I'll listen to her answer.
Okay, thank you. That's
I guess I can give the answer.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I think you have a great opportunity to hear Magda speak the rest of this week, and I'll run through it, I guess, right now.
Please do that.
Okay.
This is Magda's schedule for the rest of the week.
This week, right.
Right.
Okay. Tomorrow we go to Tina Hutspeaks. But on Monday, she's going to be visiting different centers in town and doing consulting. But Monday afternoon from 4:15 to 7:15 at North Pole High School, she's going to be speaking with my class, a graduate-level course in lifespan development, and anyone's welcome to come if they bring a potluck. And Tuesday, 12:30 to 3 in Alaska Land in the Blue Room. It's on the third floor, and that's for free. And then on Wednesday, an all-day seminar that will be at, I think, the Methodist Church, and it will be from 8:30 to 4, and you can contact Conferences and Institute at the university.
And all this information is also in the paper.
Right, it's in
and
tonight.
It's in the paper, and we have a number, 474-7335.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
If you have more questions.
Can I say one more thing?
Quick.
Quick. The following Thursday, I'm going to be starting a parent-infant class with TVCC, and people can call in.
Okay. I thank my guests in the studio. We are absolutely out of time. It's clear we could go on forever. It's been fascinating for me, and I'm not even a parent, so thank you very much for coming. Thank our audience for listening. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer has been Carla Tanella, and we hope to have you join us next week. Thank you. It's been Home Fires Radio Show.
You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and the current weather conditions show that we have a temperature of 30 degrees, the skies are partly cloudy, and we have the wind coming from the north at 5 miles per hour. And we will now join Prairie Home Companion in progress.
Rain, watch them dance about daylight to go home. How'd you like to join the party? There's fun for the youngsters too. So come on, kids, let down your hair. Good times wait for you.